From WDAV in Davidson, North Carolina, this is The Recovery Room, making sense of modern medicine. I'm Dr. Rick Green.
The way the bill works is, starting in 2014, you have a choice. You can buy insurance for yourself and for your family, or you can pay a tax on your tax return.
When Republican attorneys general started filing lawsuits against health care reform only days after the bill's passage in March, many dismissed the lawsuits as little more than political posturing. But last month, one of the lawsuits passed its first legal hurdle, maybe on its way to the Supreme Court.
If Congress had ever imposed a mandate like this on the general population, everyone in your audience would know the duties or mandates that they have to obey as an American citizen. They know of no such duties because it's never happened before.
Two constitutional law professors on opposing sides of the issue debate the individual mandate to buy health insurance. Coming up on The Recovery Room.
The Recovery Room is made possible in part by a grant from the Society of American Gastrointestinal and Endoscopic Surgeons Educational and Research Foundation.
Making sense of modern medicine. This is The Recovery Room. I'm Dr. Rick Green. Before the end of the year, many Americans will start to experience the initial portions of the health care reform bill signed into law in March by President Obama. Other changes won't take place until 2014. Including the most contentious, the individual mandate to purchase health insurance. On today's show, the constitutional debate about health care reform. We're joined by two experts in constitutional law, Georgetown Law Center Professor Randy Barnett, a vocal critic of the individual mandate, and Jack Balkin, a Yale Law professor and celebrated legal blogger who supports the law. When the health care reform bill passed by the slimmest of margins on a party-line vote earlier this year, state attorneys general were already lining up to challenge the bill on the grounds that it was unconstitutional. The main point of contention? The bill's mandate requiring individuals to purchase health insurance. Starting in 2014, failure to purchase insurance will result in a fine. At least 20 states are currently challenging the bill in court, most by Republican attorneys general or in Republican-leaning states, which contributes to the perception that the legal challenges are politically motivated. The lawsuits, like the one filed by Virginia Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli, challenge the new bill's right to regulate and tax a person's decision not to participate in interstate commerce. In August, a U.S. district judge denied the Justice Department's attempt to have Cuccinelli's lawsuit dismissed. Additional hearings have been set for October. For its part, the federal government challenges the notion that the bill taxes commercial inactivity, saying that those who refuse to buy health insurance are merely shifting the financial burden to other taxpayers when those uninsured inevitably receive care, in most cases expensive emergency care. So is the mandate to buy health insurance constitutional? And are legal challenges likely to end up being debated in the Supreme Court? Later in the show, we'll talk with Yale Law Professor Jack Balkin, who supports the new law. But joining us now is Randy Barnett. Mr. Barnett is a professor of legal theory at the Georgetown University Law Center, where he teaches constitutional law. He questions the health care bill's constitutionality and supports the legal challenges being pursued by Virginia's Ken Cuccinelli and others. Professor Barnett, thanks so much for joining us today on The Recovery Room.
It's my pleasure to be there.
Well, Virginia Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli was quoted as saying, "This lawsuit is not about health care, it is about our freedom. The government cannot draft an unwilling citizen into commerce just so it can regulate him under the Commerce Clause." So is your primary criticism of the bill from a constitutional perspective that it taxes individuals for failing to buy health insurance, for not engaging in interstate commerce?
Well, first of all, there's nothing. The bill does not refer to this as a tax. This is something that this is essentially a spin that was put on the bill by the House Joint Tax Committee the day the bill was enacted in the House. It was basically the Senate bill. The House bill did refer to it as a tax, but the Senate bill refers to it only as a penalty.
But doesn't Congress have broad authority under the Commerce Clause to regulate private decisions about health care, since those private decisions can affect the entire health care system and interstate commerce?
It does have broad authority, but just note we're shifting now the discussion from the tax power. We're putting that aside, which I think we should put aside. and now discuss the commerce power, which is a different power the Congress has. So I think that's an important shift that we need to note that we've just made.
Right.
And I think we should make that. I think that's what the courts will do. They're going to dismiss this tax power argument very quickly, I believe, because of its radical implications. And going to the Commerce Clause, yes, Congress does have a very broad authority to regulate insurance companies. However, in the history of the United States, Congress has never used its Commerce Clause authority to mandate that individuals enter into commerce or enter into an economic relationship with a private company. This has never been done before, and I can prove that to you and your audience, because if Congress had ever imposed a mandate like this on the general population, everyone in your audience would know the duties or mandates that they have to obey as an American citizen. They know of no such duties because it's never happened before. Now, there are mandates that the federal government does impose on the people, and I think it's useful to stop and think for a moment what those mandates are. They impose a mandate to register for the draft and to serve in the military if called. They impose a mandate to fill out your census form. They impose a mandate to submit a tax return. They impose a mandate to serve on a jury if you're called to serve on a jury. Those are the mandates that are imposed on the people. And all of these mandates are considered what we might call fundamental duties of American citizens. They're the price you have to pay in return for the protection that the government offers each and every person in the country. And they're traditional duties that go all the way back to the founding and, for example, the militia, in which people were obligated to come out with their own private arms and defend the community. That's the kind of duties that people have accepted. So essentially, what the people who support this mandate are saying is there is a duty to obey Congress when Congress mandates that you do something that is convenient to its regulation of interstate commerce. And that is just not something that's been traditionally part of American citizenship before. If the court upholds this mandate, it will be part of the duties of American citizenship from now on, but that will fundamentally change the relationship of the American citizen to the government.
There was a recent editorial in the New England Journal, so that's obviously something I read, by two individuals from Boston University, the School of Public Health. I know you were on the faculty there at one time, Wendy Mariner and George Annis. And I will quote them. They said, "The fundamental legal problem is whether, if the federal government can penalize individuals by refusing to purchase health insurance, there is any principle that would limit the power of the federal government to penalize the failure to purchase other products." And other products, such as a daily newspaper to save the newspaper business from extinction, is something they used. Is this a meaningful argument?
Yes. In fact, it's an argument that's being made by in Virginia and in Florida and in many other lawsuits that are being brought against the country. Yes, I think that is part and parcel of the argument. It's what we lawyers call the slippery slope argument, which is if they can do this, then they can do these other things. Another way we characterize this is the parade of horribles. If you can do this, then you can do all these other horrible things. I think that is not necessarily enough to be – it's not sufficient to carry the day, but it's a necessary part of this argument because, in fact, it's not hard to imagine that Congress could mandate, for example, if it can regulate this, it can mandate that you have regular checkups with your doctor, annual checkups to your doctor. So it mandates that you take your scarce resources and sort of pay it to your doctor. It can mandate all kinds of things as necessary and proper to its regulation of the health insurance business. And it's just something that has just never been done in this country before. It's unprecedented. And I'm inclined to think the court is not going to be sympathetic to it if it's brought to the court in the right way.
In your opinion, do you think these legal challenges will go all the way to the Supreme Court?
I really do. This is big. And if all the circuit courts of appeals uphold the bill, then there's a decent chance that the Supreme Court will take a pass. But I'm not so sure. I just don't think they will. I think this is too big. It's too public. There's too many. When the public is really focused on the constitutionality of a big thing that affects the general public the way this bill does, I think the Supreme Court pretty much feels it's incumbent upon it to get into the picture. Just the way it does, if any of the circuit courts of appeals were to find that any part of this bill was unconstitutional, the Supreme Court, although it doesn't have to, has traditionally thought that it needs to step in to evaluate when a law is being struck down by a lower court. So that's an automatic, that's almost a guarantee the Supreme Court will hear it if any circuit strikes the law down. But even if they all uphold it, I think the justices are going to feel like the public will think they're remiss in their duty if they don't take a look at this.
You know, because of your interest in the court, you've argued before the Supreme Court, the current makeup of the court, How do you assess that as far as answering or getting to an eventual decision on this project, on this process?
Well, I'm sad to say, I hesitate to say this, but I'm afraid it's true. I would predict there are four ironclad votes in favor of upholding this bill, no matter what the constitutional arguments are against it. It's not something that, as a law professor or as an American citizen, I'm very pleased to say. I would like to think that all nine justices would have an open mind about these things, but that's how I would break this down. Four votes the government starts with right off the bat, and then the question is, can they pick up a fifth of these five? And, you know, I think the smart money always is that they can, because the court likes to uphold federal laws when they can. But I actually think in this case, it's the odds are of a successful challenge are increasing on a daily basis. And I think there's because the arguments are very valid, I think that there's a very good chance that and also the implication of upholding this mandate are pretty radical. I think there's a reasonably good chance that you'd have five votes to strike this mandate down.
We're talking with Randy Barnett, professor of legal theory at Georgetown Law Center, where he teaches constitutional law. And Randy's also the author of Restoring the Lost Constitution, The Resumption of Liberty. You know, Randy, let me ask you, even Judge Henry Hudson, who upheld the Virginia challenge, was recently quoted as saying that the case, quote, has a distinctive political undercurrent, close quote. Do you agree with Judge Hudson?
I don't think there's any question about that. For one thing, let me just take a minute to remark upon the significance of Judge Hudson's ruling. Prior to his ruling, a lot of law professors and many politicians kept repeating, and especially Democrats in states where their attorney generals had joined this lawsuit, claimed that this lawsuit was frivolous, that there was no basis for it, in fact. And I'm sure that you've heard that from other people, and your listeners have heard that from other people. Even though Judge Hudson did not rule on the merits of this lawsuit, what he did rule in his ruling was that this is a serious challenge, because had the lawsuit been deemed by him to be frivolous, he would have been obligated to dismiss it. You dismiss frivolous claims. So his ruling is highly significant, and I can tell you that if it had come out the other way, you would have heard howls of protest against the continuation of these lawsuits on the grounds that these arguments are frivolous after all. But we have an official adjudication that they are not frivolous. Now, if I can get to your question about the political overtones, is that the word you use?
Undercurrent.
Undercurrent, yeah. Overtones, undercurrent.
Right.
We got to pick our metaphor. yes, of course there is. Why wouldn't this is what politics are for. This bill was passed on a bare political majority over the opposition of a majority of the American people, as reflected by polling data at the time the bill was enacted. And with many, many Democrats voting against it because of its unpopularity. So, of course, this is and now it's being injected into the next political election cycle, of course. But that's what we have politics in this country for.
Randy, let me ask you, as a constitutional expert and a law professor, do you take a particular pleasure in having this as a public debate that everybody can join in on?
Frankly, I mean, my honest opinion is that the principle of this bill is so abhorrent and contrary to our constitutional traditions that I hate to be having this conversation because the danger that this and the negative implications of upholding this bill are so great, and I do think that the odds typically are that the court will uphold these bills. I just wish we weren't having this conversation. That would be my first reaction. My second reaction is that I am gratified that millions and millions of the American people are now focusing on the Constitution in a way that they haven't throughout my whole lifetime. I focused on it, but a lot of people just want to, I mean, they just go about their businesses, they should, and not really focused on these matters, and they're focused on them now. And there's millions of people, tens of thousands in the street, people are in the streets talking about the Constitution, going to town hall meetings, confronting their representatives with constitutional objections, reading the Constitution. I am very, very gratified about that. But it may very well be that the happy ending of the story is that this overreaching federal power has created a movement for what some people are calling constitutional conservatism that has previously not existed in this country. And we could end up having a big happy ending here, but it's a very big risk to run before you reach a happy ending.
We've been talking with Professor Randy Barnett, professor of legal theory at the Georgetown Law Center, where he teaches constitutional law. He's also the author of Restoring the Lost Constitution, The Resumption of Liberty. Randy, thanks so much for joining us today on The Recovery Room.
It's been my pleasure.
Making Sense of Modern Medicine, this is The Recovery Room. I'm Dr. Rick Green. We're online at recoveryroomshow.org. So, is healthcare reform ushering in a new era that empowers the government to force individuals into contracts with private businesses? Or is the individual mandate to buy health insurance, scheduled to go into effect in 2014, a unique solution to a unique problem? And is this solution constitutional? Joining us now is Professor Jack Balkin. Mr. Balkin is the Knight Professor of Constitutional Law and the First Amendment at Yale Law School. He also writes political and legal commentary at his blog, Balkinization. In June, Professor Balkin, along with two constitutional law professors from Columbia University, submitted an amicus brief in support of the federal government's motion to dismiss a lawsuit filed by Virginia Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli challenging the individual mandate to buy health insurance. In August, U.S. District Court Judge Henry Hudson refused to dismiss Cuccinelli's lawsuit, stating that legal precedents were inconclusive. It might take years, but the lawsuit could be on its way to the Supreme Court. Professor Balkin, thanks so much for joining us today on The Recovery Room.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask you that according to critics of the individual mandate, like Randy Barnett, the government has never before ordered Americans to purchase a product from a private business and impose a tax on those who refuse, and that by doing so is a dangerous precedent that has been set. What's wrong with Barnett's interpretation of that?
Well, the question is how you understand what's actually going on here. The individual mandate is actually not even a mandate. It's a tax that you have to pay if you don't have qualified health care insurance. So you can pay the tax or you can buy insurance. That's basically how it works. And many, many people are exempted. If you're too poor to pay the tax, you don't have to pay it. If you have religious objections, you don't have to pay it. If you're in the military, you don't have to pay it. If you live overseas, you don't have to pay it. If you have health insurance through Medicare or Medicaid, you don't have to pay it. And, of course, if you have health insurance on your own, you don't have to pay it. So it's basically it's a tax on activity that the government wants to create a disincentive for. And the way it's done, basically, is by giving you an option.
Let me get back to a minute about the language of the bill, whether we're dealing with a tax, whether we're dealing with a penalty, whether
we're dealing with both. It, from the standpoint of the law, it doesn't really matter what you call it. The real question is, how does it work? The way the bill works is, starting in 2014, you have a choice. You can buy insurance for yourself and for your family, or you can pay a tax on your tax return. You could call it a penalty. That's fine. I don't really care whether you call it a penalty or a tax. What I care about is how it works.
Do you have any concerns about a precedent being set that could force citizens into other relationships with private businesses?
Well, no, not really. I mean, I think health insurance is really a unique situation. I think that's really the way to think about it. Health insurance requires that you have a large number of people in a risk pool. And if you want to have a shall issue rule, that is that the insurer can't deny you coverage because of a pre-existing condition or can't put lifetime caps on the amount of insurance they provide, you actually have to expand the risk pool. There are several ways to do that. The individual mandate is one. A single-payer solution is another. A public option solution is still a third. Ironically, from the standpoint of the critics of the individual mandate, the position that was chosen by Congress is the most protective of private enterprise. That is, many of the critics of the individual mandate were furious about the idea of a public option and even more furious about the idea of a single-payer solution. The solution Congress chose actually benefits private enterprise. So it's a very strange set of bedfellows we have here.
And this is the importance that you were bringing up about this risk pool. We all need to get involved in the risk pool.
Well, we will one way or another be involved in the risk pool. The problem with an insurance market is that there's a problem of what's called adverse selection. That is, the people who are most likely to purchase insurance are the people who think they will need insurance. That's people who are older and people who have pre-existing conditions. People who are younger and people who think they won't get sick. These are the people who will think that they have an economic reason not to enter the risk pool, right? The whole point of this scheme of regulation is to give people the right to get insurance without whether or not they have a pre-existing condition in return for everybody participating in the risk pool. That is to say, because everybody goes in, insurance is made cheaper, and more people can be can get insurance even if they have a pre-existing condition. And that's the kind of social contract, if you will, that's the point of the individual mandate. It's tied to the idea that you can't be denied insurance because you have a pre-existing condition. You really can't have one reform without the other.
You know, it seems that the concept we've been talking about and about where the public is required to engage in these insurance programs is a form of social insurance. I think you've actually used that term.
Yes, and it goes way back. I mean, it goes really back to the pensions for Revolutionary War veterans and then for Civil War soldiers and then to the creation of forms of workers' compensation at the beginning of the 20th century, Social Security, which is really the most important social insurance mechanism we have today, Medicare and Medicaid or others. A lot of citizenship today involves contributions by citizens to pools of money that are used to insure people. That's what Social Security is about. I think that's really what this law is about, too. What's interesting about this law is that it uses private insurance companies as the intermediaries for this form of insurance, whereas Social Security, as you know, doesn't. Social Security uses the government as the person who basically manages the risk pool. One of the ironies is that in 2004, George W. Bush wanted to privatize Social Security or partially privatize it, and what that would have done was essentially create something like a system in which you would have used a private company to manage your Social Security assets. There's a great irony in the fact that the Republicans now are very much opposed to this model because it does have something in common, a little in common, with the idea of privatizing Social Security.
Let me ask about politics for a minute. I mean, there's no question, I think, anybody following this, that this bill was passed really along party lines. In your opinion, though, as a legal scholar, does this make challenges to the law any more or less likely to be seriously taken by the court, the Supreme Court?
I don't think so. I mean, obviously, if the law becomes extremely unpopular, if the Republican Party were to sweep control of the government and appoint new judges and justices, that would obviously have a predictable effect on how courts would think about the law. But the reason why the bill went along party lines is overdetermined. It has to do with what was the best political strategy for the Republican Party at the time. It has, because in fact the idea of an individual mandate was an idea that didn't come from liberal Democrats, it came from conservative Republicans. It was the idea of choosing a method for securing health care that was most protective of private enterprise. And indeed, that's ultimately the path that Congress chose because of compromises that had to have been made in the Senate. You remember, it takes 60 votes to get anything passed in the Senate. But it was just not in the interest of national Republicans to get behind this bill. As you can see, it's part of the general strategy of trying to get back into power. And basically, that's the reason why the bill ended up the way it did.
We're talking to Jack Balkin, a professor of law at Yale Law School and a legal scholar in the Constitution, about the mandates and the Obama health care plan. Can you just explain briefly the Virginia case and your opinion of the judge's ruling?
Well, the Virginia case is a case brought by the state of Virginia arguing that the law, the individual mandate part of the law, is unconstitutional. And what the judge said was that Virginia had standing to raise these claims, which is a controversial question in itself, that Virginia was not barred by what's called the Tax Anti-Injunction Act, and that the judge would delay deciding on the merits, the constitutionality of the lawsuit. The Tax Anti-Injunction Act, I should explain, is a law that Congress passed, I think it was in the 20s, which was designed to keep people from enjoining taxes, because lots of people would then seek to declare parts of the Internal Revenue Code unconstitutional. You can imagine the number of people who would bring lawsuits, and said that if you want to challenge the legality of a tax, you have to sue for a refund from the IRS after that you pay the tax. And what Virginia said is, we don't want to have to wait for someone to pay the tax and then ask for a refund. We want to sue now. And what the court said was, well, it's possible that nobody else could raise the claims that the state of Virginia would raise, because Virginia wants to claim that its sovereignty has been impeded by the new federal law. Now, I don't actually agree with the judge, because I think lots of people are lining up to sue to claim that the law is unconstitutional and it violates principles of state sovereignty. So that part of the case I disagree with, but I understand why the judge decided it. The judge decided it in order because he wanted to get to the merits. And it's possible, at this point, it's possible he will decide the merits on the papers, as he could have done a couple of weeks ago. It's possible he'll simply say, I want an evidentiary hearing on some particular question, which I doubt he'll do, but it's possible he could do it.
What do you think the chance of this whole thing getting to the Supreme Court?
Well, that really depends on whether or not any circuit court would strike down the law. If the circuit courts all agree the law is constitutional, which if they follow the law, they will, then it will never get to the Supreme Court because the Supreme Court won't have any particular reason. If one circuit court decides the law is unconstitutional, then there will be a strong incentive for the Supreme Court to take the case.
Along these lines, Barnett suggested that if the case were to make it to the court, the Supreme Court, based on the court's current makeup, the government would automatically have 4 votes in its favor. Do you share that?
I suspect the government would probably automatically have 5 votes in its favor, maybe 6 or 7. I think that under current law, the bill is almost sure to be constitutional. On the other hand, if the court follows the law, as we say, the law is constitutional. If the court were to strike down the law, it would be because a majority of the justices decided to change the law. And they decided to change it in a really radical way, in my view. They would have to say, for example, that Congress's Commerce Clause power didn't extend this far, but its power to tax didn't extend this far. This would require overturning or significantly narrowing a wide range of precedents going all the way back to the New Deal.
Let me ask you, as a constitutional law professor, do you take some pleasure in seeing that the discussion of the Constitution and this battle has sort of been made public?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's wonderful that we're having a discussion about what our social contract, if you will, is about, and how the federal government is structured. I don't necessarily agree with all the positions that are being raised in public, but as a constitutional lawyer, I think it's very important that Americans take their Constitution seriously, that they have a stake in what their Constitution means, that they tell their elected officials, and that they tell each other what they think the Constitution means. That's how our Constitution stays in touch with popular sovereignty.
Professor Jack Balkin, thanks for being with us today on The Recovery Room.
It's my pleasure.
Jack Balkin is the Knight Professor of Constitutional Law and the First Amendment at Yale Law School. He also writes political and legal commentary at his blog, Balkinization. For more information on the lawsuits that have been filed against health care reform by state attorneys general, and for more information about the health care reform bill, visit recoveryroomshow.org. That's it for this week's show. More information about this or upcoming episodes of The Recovery Room, visit recoveryroomshow.org. Thanks to Sam Van Halgren, who produces the show, and to Recovery Room Special Advisors, Drs. Lance Stell and Christy Foley of the Davidson College Medical Humanities Program. The Recovery Room intern is Sydney Rockwell. Thanks also to Patty Silverman and at WDAV, Linda Ray, Lisa Gray, Kim Klein, and General Manager Ben Rowe. I'm Dr. Rick Green. Thanks so much for listening.
The Recovery Room is made possible in part by a grant from the Society of American Gastrointestinal and Endoscopic Surgeons Educational and Research Foundation. The Recovery Room is a production of 89.9 WDAV, a service of Davidson College in Davidson, North Carolina. Find us on the web at recoveryroomshow.org.